Hello and welcome to Animal Voices on CAUT 89.5. We've got a great show lined up for you today. We're going to be talking with John Sorensen. He's a sociology professor in my department, the Department of Sociology at Brock University. He teaches courses in critical animal studies, globalization, and anti-racism, and received his HBA and MA from the University of Alberta and his PhD from York University in social and political thought. He's currently working on a SHRC-funded project on various ways of representing animals, and we'll be talking with him about his most recent books, Ape and About Canada Animal Rights. This is a pre-recorded interview that we had an opportunity to conduct on Sunday evening, and Lauren hosts most of the interview, so you'll get to hear her lovely voice soon enough. John is an aspiring figure in the field of critical animal studies. In fact, he inspired me to first become interested in animal issues, and it was in his class that I went vegan, actually. And he's going to be giving a talk here at the University of Toronto in a few weeks to promote his new book, along with Rob Laidlaw from ZooCheck Canada, a friend of the show, who has just written a new book entitled On Parade, The Hidden World of Animals and Entertainment, and Andrew Westall, a former monkey researcher whose travel memoir, The River Bones, describes his journey into the remote jungles of Suriname. This is happening on Thursday, December 2nd at 7 p.m. in the George Ignatieff Theatre here at the University of Toronto. Tickets are $8 in advance. You can get them from ZooCheck at 416-285-1744 or just go online to their website. So before we get into the interview, we have to do our regular segments here on Animal Voices, and the first of these is, of course, the news. I wanted to read a piece from Bloomberg Businessweek entitled The Rise of the Power Vegans, which highlights some various vegan elites, celebrities, political elites, from Dennis Kucinich, Mike Tyson, Madonna. The article has all kinds of interesting insights, such as stating that most men go vegan because of their wives, and that they're influenced by their partners to do this. And this was news to me, that veganism's really expensive, apparently. The tone of the article didn't really mesh well with our show, what we do here, so I decided to forego reading that piece. But I would encourage our listeners to check it out online. You can just Google The Rise of the Power Vegans, and that's available from Bloomberg Businessweek. So I do have two pieces this week. They're pretty much within the tone of our usual stuff here. Our first article this week is coming to us from Mail Online UK. Backlash after budget supermarket Lidl launches reindeer meat for Christmas. A discount supermarket chain has been accused of destroying the magic of Christmas after putting reindeer steaks on its shelves. Lidl, which has more than 500 shops in Britain, is the first multiple grocery retail in the UK to introduce reindeer meat in the run-up to the festive season. The frozen steaks, which cost $5.99 for a 350-gram pack, were launched this week under the Deluxe Premium label. But campaigning group Viva has slammed Lidl for selling the meat, claiming reindeer are often herded in cruel ways. Campaigns manager Justin Kurzweil told trade magazine The Grocer, Lidl is destroying the magic of Christmas by selling dead reindeer. What they term luxury cuisine belies the truth behind an industry that exists to exploit wild animals. Reports show that up to 70% of reindeer killed for meat are calves. Mr. Kurzweil said the Siberian reindeer were often herded by snowmobile, motorbikes, and even helicopters, which causes the animals high levels of stress. Quote, "This and lassoing them can cause huge distress. They can become so distraught that their muscle can waste away," end quote. According to the research in the Polar Research Journal, the numbers of reindeer in Siberia has declined dramatically since the post-Soviet era. Mr. Kurzweil added, "Commercializing reindeer in the West may put numbers further under risk." Lidl has defended the sale and said that the meat that come from reindeer are fed on local aromatic herbs and grass. A spokesperson told the magazine, "They live in their natural habitat and have plenty of space to move around." The store chain is also selling pheasant, venison, and springbok in a bid to capitalize on its premium appeal. It has also signed up celebrity chefs Leslie Waters and Nick Naran to produce weekly recipe cards in the run-up to Christmas. Our second article this week is coming to us from Public Opinion Online. Nearly 1,000 dead pigs found on Fulton County Farm. Between 950 and 1,000 dead pigs were found Monday on a Fulton County farm where they had apparently been abandoned months ago to die of starvation. Humane Society Police Officer Dennis Brumbaugh said he had never seen anything like it before. He said the incident may be the largest of its kind in Pennsylvania's history. Quote, "I was horrified when I opened the door and saw what I saw," he said during an interview Tuesday. Brumbaugh was on his way to the Union Township farm of Daniel and Karen Clark to begin counting the carcasses and assessing the evidence. The carcasses were reported to authorities by Karen Clark on Monday, and Brumbaugh responded to the Harmon Lane property for an initial look at the situation. "All I know at this point is what I'm dealing with is a heck of a lot of dead animals," he said. The Clarks had separated in recent years, and Daniel Clark reportedly left the farm for the last time in August, Brumbaugh said. Based on the level of their decomposition, he estimates the pigs died somewhere in the last several months. Karen Clark had not been to the farm since 2008, he said. She recently acquired the property and has been completely cooperative with the authorities. "This lady is devastated," Brumbaugh said. On Tuesday, the 218-acre farm was listed for sale at a price of $1.2 million by realtor Rebecca A. Glasner of Long & Foster Real Estate. According to the online listing, the farm includes two hog finishing barns, grain silos, and a 1900s farmhouse that, quote, needs work. "I knew there were some dead animals up there, but not this many," Glasner said in a phone interview Tuesday after being told about the discovery. Glasner said she recently visited the property, which has been on the market for about 3 weeks, and did not see any carcasses while she was there. She said she is not concerned about how many hundreds of dead hogs might affect the property's saleability. Quote, "I think this is very normal in a lot of farming operations, that you're going to have dead animals," she said. The pigs had been living inside buildings on the property, and the majority of them were found still inside, Brumbaugh said. There is evidence of an effort to escape, and a few animals were found dead outside. Quote, "It was a horrible situation. They struggled and fought to get out," Brumbaugh said. Among the dead hogs, Brumbaugh also found what appear to be the remains of about 6 calves. He said Daniel Clark will likely be charged pending further investigation. Amy Bradford, executive director of the Pennsylvania Pork Producers Council, said Clark had not been actively involved with the council, nor is he a member of the Penn Ag Industries Association. "Certainly we're alarmed by this type of situation, and will work to assist the Humane Society as they determine whether this is an animal health issue or a criminal investigation," she said. According to Bradford, Tuesday's market value for hogs was 45 cents per pound, and the average market hog weighs 265 pounds. At that rate, the average full-grown hog would be worth about $120. "This value is very variable and changes on a daily basis," she wrote in an email. Nicole Boucher, spokesperson for the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture, said a department veterinarian and an inspector with the State Bureau of Animal Health were traveling to Fulton County late Tuesday afternoon. "They're going to inspect what's happening there and see what type of assistance they would be able to offer," she said. "The investigation is primarily conducted by the Humane Society, with assistance from other agencies including the Department of Agriculture, the State Department of Environmental Protection, and Pennsylvania State Police, McConnellsburg." "The Humane Society asked us to be involved in determining cause of death," Boucher said, "but it seems the state of the carcasses may be too decayed for an accurate necropsy." She said the department's role in the case will be limited to the proper disposal of the carcasses. After the incident is properly documented, the dead pigs may be buried or incinerated.
And that's all of our news for today. I just wanted to say that I felt like the first piece really puts in a stark relief the kind of moral inconsistency, or schizophrenia, as Gary Francione might say, of our attitudes towards animals. There's all this upheaval about reindeer meat being served in the lead-up to the holidays, and yet no one seems to mind the cow or pig flesh that I'm sure bookends this controversial meat on the shelf. That second article, too, I mean, they point out that the pigs are worth, what, $120 each. It's pretty easy to leave behind that many living, breathing animals when you view them only as economic commodities. So we're going to move on to our interview with John Sorensen in just a few minutes. However, I just want to remind our listeners that if they have any show ideas, an important piece of news, an event or story you want us to cover or plug, please feel free to drop us a line at animalvoices@gmail.com and check us out on our website, animalvoices.ca, or on Facebook. Neil, our tech god, has just recently added Facebook share buttons to our archive shows, so if you want to share a particular show on your wall or with some friends, you can do that now. Please feel free to do that. For instance, if you have some locavore friends and you want to post our show with locavore activist, whose name escapes me at the moment, but you could just type in locavore and you could post that on their wall, perhaps. Finally, before we move on to the interview, we're going to continue our newest segment with Kevin Tillman of the Vegan Hip Hop Movement. Each week for the last few, and from now on, Kevin will be bringing us a new track from a vegan hip-hop artist for our listening pleasure. So let's see what he has for us this week.
Greetings, Animal Voices, and your lovely listeners. This is Kevin from the Vegan Hip-Hop Movement. Be sure to seek us out on both MySpace and Facebook. This week we have a song from an artist from Oakland who simply gives a damn, by the name of Ramo Conscious. This song is entitled Lies.
Everything is ready, turns out to be a lie. It may have started with the Easter Bunny or St. Nicholas, even more ridiculous, the Tooth Fairy. From there we're forced to recite the pledge, Hail Mary. One nation under God, why us? Don't question, son, you're burning hell. Pay attention to the lies that we're told to tell. Teacher teaches us Columbus was a hero. He stole lands, he stole lives of so-called Indians, from the Tainos to the Africans. Respect Thomas Jefferson? He molested Sally Hemings, and now they say Reagan was a great man. The godfather of crack babies? Denier of the AIDS plague? I ran fast as I could to the library to find out they traced the books I read. These lies got me surrounded. There's a war on truth. Ain't it on me? It started with that first lie's truth. Lies, it's all lies, everything they say. Lies, they keep telling lies, we hear them every day. Think that we don't know that you're up to no good when you're telling lies. They say milk does the body good. How so? It causes disease. Don't trust me? Read about BGH and RGF-1. The dairy industry has a stricken poison. Got milk? Better yet, how about? Got cancer? Got a sick prostate? And you're looking for answers, and why we trust the FDA to protect us? These mad cows are milking us all the way to the bank. From cell phones to pharmaceuticals, children force vaccinations that carry plague and chemicals. Corporate thugs push drugs like evangelists push miracles. Monsanto, Bayer, Procter & Gamble. Fluoride in our water supply has got us all cockeyed, but still they lie, telling us it's for our own good. First Jews in Nazi prison camps, now it's in our hoods. Lies, it's all lies, everything they say. Lies, they keep telling lies, we hear them every day. Do you think that we don't know that you're up to no good when you're telling lies? From Fox News to the New York Post, and all these lying neocon right-wing news show hosts, Bill O'Reilly makes me nauseous. Hannity and Combs are drones for these greedy corporate monsters. Fitting lies to the public, they love it with puppets intimidated and controlled by color codes, where lie becomes truth and truth becomes myth. Lost in the Rupert Murdoch and Clear Channel abyss. If you don't agree with Bush and you're unpatriotic, even if you've never known a man this psychotic in control of the so-called free and the brave, you become timid and afraid, eager to become slaves. The Patriot Act is good for the people. It's like saying the Bush regime will protect us from evil. How many lies can they tell in just 4 years? I say the worst is yet to come, so it's time to prepare. Lies, it's all lies, everything they say. Lies, they keep telling lies, we hear them every day. Do you think that we don't know that you're up to no good when you're telling lies? We saw the towers fall to ashes like they were laced with bombs. Are you sure only two planes did that harm? You told us Flight 77 hit the Pentagon. But there's no photos of parts, man. Plus the science is wrong, you let it happen. Like FDR did Pearl Harbor so you could profit from war. Sorta like your father taking lies and oil in the name of freedom. Our innocent are either tortured, left homeless or bleeding. Death to America is what they scream while you preach freedom and the American dream. Troops dying, mothers crying, still trying to cope while you're denying that the dangers from Iraq was a hoax. You're not a man of the people, just a product of evil. Greed, power, and God, a combination that's lethal. So deceitful is criminal, but soon the truth will rise. Lies. Everything they said turns out to be a lie.
Welcome back to Animal Voices. If you're just joining us, that track was Lies by Remo Conscious from the album Infiltration. We're going to head over to our pre-recorded interview with John Sorensen now. Please stay tuned.
Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Steve Romanen, co-hosting with me today. We're speaking with Professor John Sorensen about his two new books. I guess they're still relatively new. We're talking with him about a book called Ape, and we're also speaking with him about another really great comprehensive book called About Canada Animal Rights, and this is out with Fernwood. And the other one is part of the Reaction series. There's a whole bunch of different animals that are featured in that series. And as I mentioned, John wrote a book called Ape. We're very pleased to have him on the program today. He is a colleague of mine in the Department of Sociology at Brock University and a mentor to both myself and to Steve here. So we're pretty much delighted to have him on the show. It's been a long time coming, although we've had shorter interviews with John in the past. So I wanted to warmly welcome you, John, to Animal Voices.
Hi, Lauren.
So I'm going to turn the mic over to Steve, and we'll hear a little bit about your background and how you came to thinking about animal issues.
Hi, John. So as Lauren mentioned, you're a mentor to both of us, but I think for me especially, it was your globalization class that first brought me to animal issues, and it was in your animal and human society course, the second year course, that I went vegan. And I was wondering, what brought you to animal issues?
Well, like many other people, I've always been interested in animals. And I guess why I started thinking about animal rights issues more seriously is because of this same social justice context that you talked about in reference to the globalization course. I just, you know, see this as the same sort of issues, the treatment of animals, the treatment of human beings. I see them as quite similar.
So you were able to draw parallels between the oppression of people and the oppression of animals?
Yeah, I see them as similar issues. I don't see why those who are concerned about one wouldn't be concerned about the other.
And what about on an emotional level? I know Lauren was telling me before the interview that when she interviewed for you for the Brock Review, you mentioned that your dogs were a big inspiration for you.
Oh, sure. You know, we had one dog first. When he moved into our house, you know, we started thinking about, you know, who is this little fellow and, you know, what's his world like, and I felt a responsibility to improve things for him.
Do you think that's typical of people, their first interactions with animals outside of, you know, the context of eating their flesh is with their animals at home?
Well, I think for many people it is, but for others not. I mean, if you think of Peter Singer's book, Animal Liberation, he talks about not even really, you know, being interested in animals or liking them that much, but, you know, approaching it from a philosophical perspective. So I guess it varies depending upon the person.
You became a vegetarian in the 1970s. What kind of cultural and societal shifts have you seen in regards to that and in regards to animal issues as well?
Well, you know, when I became a vegetarian, it was just brown rice and vegetables stirred up in the wok, you know. And now it's so easy to be vegan. I mean, there are so many products and so many stores where you can buy alternative foods. Panacea store in Toronto, for example, you can get just about anything you want there, and, you know, all sorts of restaurants, non-leather shoes, and not very difficult to find. So it's really changed so much.
So in terms of access to foods, obviously that's something that's changed, but does that actually mirror a true change in consciousness societally?
Well, you'd like to think so, wouldn't you? But yeah, I think that there is a change in consciousness. I mean, a few years ago, nobody even had heard of the word vegan, but now, you know, for example, in the Toronto Star newspaper, there's an article recently, in my neighborhood, there's a raw food vegan restaurant called Raw Aura, which is great. And in the newspaper, they had a, you know, positive article about this restaurant and a recipe that people can try out. And, until quite recently, vegetarianism even, you know, it would have just been a joke term.
Yeah.
You know, to some extent, it still is. But, you know, I think that there is a growing appreciation for vegetarianism, veganism, healthy eating, and so on. Yeah.
I feel that we're catching you on an optimistic day.
Yeah, I think so.
Because, as we've spoken about before, we see this growing interest in the academy, in what some people are calling the question of the animal, and there's more folks like yourself who have addressed these issues in your scholarship. and we see, hopefully, you know, an increase in activism and that kind of thing. But at the same time, we see an increase in not only the numbers of animals that are used, but also the types of uses. And we just had Richard Twine on talking about his new book, Animal Biotechnology, and these ever-increasing ways, new ways to exploit animals. And I'm wondering how you sort of reconcile those two things, sort of what keeps you getting up out of bed in the morning, as I put it to Richard Twine, given this kind of juggernaut of capitalism and all these new technologies that we have now to exploit animals in new and creative and more horrible ways.
Well, I mean, there's no point in lying in bed and groaning about it. That's not to, you know, help anybody. So, you know, you have to give it a try. And sure, I mean, it's not going to be easy, and people are always going to try and find ways to profit from animals and to get new horrifying means to exploit them. But, you know, I think that there is a growing sense among many people that maybe this isn't the way we should be going. So I like to try and emphasize that.
You mentioned at the beginning of the interview with Steve that this linking of social justice and animal issues is very important to you, and that's your background is in critical race theory and anti-globalization and those sorts of issues. And I was wondering if you could speak more specifically about that for people. Maybe I don't know if you have a cocktail version of why you're interested in animal rights or why this is a compelling issue to you, but for the average listener who might never have heard of these issues before, what do you say about why you do animal rights-related work?
Well, I just see, as I said, animal rights as being part of a long tradition of progressive thought and activism to try and make a better world. And, you know, I see myself as working in that tradition, although not making a very big contribution compared to what others have done. But, yeah, I see it just as a continuum of more compassionate, socially just thinking and acting.
But why would you say that animals matter?
Why do they matter?
Yeah.
Because they're alive and their lives matter to them. They're capable of feeling joy in their lives and experiencing pain, and I think that we ought to pay attention to that and not just say, well, it's all about us.
I think maybe we're going to take a short break and we'll come back and continue the interview and get into some of the specifics of the two books that we're going to be speaking about today, Ape by John Swornson and, of course, your other book called About Canada Animal Rights. So please do stay tuned. We'll come back with Professor John Swornson on Animal Voices. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. Today we are speaking with Professor John Swornson about his books Ape and also another book called About Canada Animal Rights. And I wanted to get into a conversation about this intro book about Canada Animal Rights to start off with. And I'm joining many people in celebrating this book because there's such a need for up-to-date statistics and information about what's happening to animals in Canada. But I'm amazed that this book is so small in a way. It's part of a larger project that Fernwood has been engaged with tackling different issues. And there's so much really to talk about. But this book has already caused quite a few ripples in the activist community because people are excited to see that there's a sort of clearinghouse now for information about animal rights, specifically in Canada. And John, I was wondering about how you went about approaching this very broad topic and how you chose what to include and what not to.
Okay, well, as you said, it's a very short book because that's what Fernwood wanted, so I didn't have the opportunity to go into too much depth about any particular topic. So I tried to give an overview of a number of issues, and of course I wanted to frame the use and the treatment of animals as a serious social justice issue. And I wanted to address some of the basic concerns of animal rights. First of all, the major form of exploitation of animals in terms of numbers, you know, exploitation for food, but also vivisection and pet keeping and using them for clothing, especially the fur industry. But some things seemed obvious to include in the book, the seal hunt, for example, because that's what people know about Canada. But unfortunately, that's the image that we're famous for besides Mounties. And I guess, you know, hunting in general, because Canada has been seen as a big empty space where wealthy people can and other obvious things like the Calgary Stampede, the cowboy dress-up spectacle, where people can demonstrate their domination over animals. You know, those things seem, you know, like I had to include them.
Yeah, it's interesting what defines us as a nation. One of the things that's interesting for me is that my students over the years, and just people who found out that I've been involved with Animal Voices, will often think that Canada treats our animals better than other places, specifically in relationship to the United States. And that's kind of interesting, weighed against this notion that Canada is also a horrible place for animals in regards to the seal hunt. And I'm wondering if you can just comment on nationalism and animals in Canada. And how do we really compare, actually, in your mind, with other countries at this point?
Well, I think that Canadians do have a tendency to be somewhat self-congratulatory, not just about animal issues, but in general. Comparing ourselves to the United States, we like to see ourselves as being, you know, more peaceful and more compassionate and kinder and so on. But in fact, that doesn't seem to be very accurate. We've always been quite ready to profit from U.S. military aggression, you know, Vietnam War and things like that. But in terms of the treatment of animals, I don't see much difference between Canada and the U.S. or other, well, of course, in the U.S. it's on a much bigger scale. But I think that the processes are generally the same. And in fact, in terms of what's often called animal welfare, Canada may even be worse than many other countries. For example, Netherlands claims that it's more humane because of its form of killing poultry in their slaughterhouses, controlled atmosphere killing, whereas in Canada we like to hem them in the so-called electrical bath. That's not a bath anybody would want. Of course, this doesn't really stun many animals into unconsciousness as it's supposed to. So those birds are, you know, torn apart while they're still alive. Also in Canada, in terms of transport laws, we allow animals to be driven from the factory farm to the slaughterhouse for days without food or water, whereas in other countries they have regulations that put lower limits on these transportation times.
Is it part of our self-congratulatory dominant culture in a way that is precluding us from actually making meaningful changes for animals? Why are we lagging behind some of these other places, although they are far from ideal as well?
Yeah, well, I don't think that it's just, you know, our self-image that prevents us from seeing what's actually happening. Because these industries, of course, don't want people to see what they're doing, and they want to present a picture of everything being okay and being genuinely concerned about the animals that they're killing by the millions. So they spend, you know, millions of dollars on propaganda to create these images of animal welfare and benevolence and concern. And in terms of things like animal cruelty laws, in fact, Canada is lagging far behind many other countries. There's a study done by the International Fund for Animal Welfare called Falling Behind that compared Canada's animal cruelty laws to 12 other countries. And we didn't come out very well in that comparison. As you know, over the last decade or so, there's been an effort by humane societies and advocates to improve Canada's animal cruelty laws, but all of the industries that exploit animals, agribusiness, breeders, and equestrian groups, and vivisectionists, hunters, they all mobilized to stop those even minor improvements because they recognize that, you know, any kind of step forward is a threat to their interests. So, you know, it's not just something that we've overlooked, but I think that there is this interest on the part of many people. But, you know, there are powerful groups that are opposing them. Mm.
In the face of that kind of indoctrination, the propaganda that you point to, obviously your work is about countering those perspectives and showing the stuff that does get hidden. How do you suggest that people... I guess it's a question about what to do in the face of that kind of extreme propaganda and that amount of money, that publishing books and doing campaigns are obviously important, but where do you see sort of strategically the best places that people can put their efforts in terms of both finding out about what's happening to animals and then actually creating meaningful change?
Well, I think that people should do what they're interested in. And I think that if people have a particular passion for a certain topic, you know, they should follow that up. And then, you know, as they get more involved, they will start to make connections with other issues and to see that there are interrelationships between many of these structures of exploitation. If I knew exactly what to do, well, then we would have solved the problem long ago.
In terms of the major issues for you that stand out and major concerns that you raise in the book, what do you want to highlight for our listeners, realizing, of course, they're all very important and certainly important to every individual who's affected? If you could highlight for us some of the major concerns that you had coming out of the book.
Well, I think that one thing I would like people to understand is that this is not necessarily the way that it has to be. But this is a reality which has been created by these powerful interests, and that if people are disturbed by some of the things that they read in the book, which is what people have told me. Some people have said, oh, it's so depressing, I don't want to hear it. But I think that if those things do affect people and disturb them, then I think that they should think there's something that they can do about it to change them.
You had also mentioned the social justice piece is important to you, and Steve had said that you draw parallels, make connections with issues of human oppression and environmental oppression as well. And I was wondering if you could talk more specifically about what that means for you. What are some of the connections that you see?
Well, I think that it's clear that the process of exploiting others, no matter who they are, is always helped along by ideologies and propaganda and techniques of devaluing those others and making their lives seem less valuable than your own. And I think that that operates the same way, whether it's racism or sexism or imperialism or speciesism. And if we look, say, at the history of racist thought, it's clear that animal imagery has always been very prominent and consistent in that propaganda. The process of animalization is used to deny compassion and justice to those groups who are being subjugated. So the parallels are pretty clear. So that's one connection that I would draw. I think that the major way in which forms of oppression are entangled would be through the global meat system. Not only does this involve terrible suffering and death for animals, but it's directly linked to environmental degradation, the pollution of air and water and soil, and harmful effects on human beings through exposure to these toxic materials, and also through the consumption of animal products in terms of obesity and heart disease and cancer and so on. But it's also linked to the displacement of large numbers of people, peasants in Latin America and so on, often achieved through direct violence by armed thugs that have been paid by large ranchers and so on. And critically, it's linked to the process of global warming and climate change, which is going to have devastating effects, first of all, on the poorest and most vulnerable people in the world, and then eventually upon all the rest of us, with the likelihood that, you know, the planet will become uninhabitable for human life. So I think it's worth paying attention to these interconnections.
One of the things I found with doing this work for myself over the years, that those sorts of connections become more and more obvious, but despite the saliency of those connections, there's a tendency, I think, within some social justice circles to really see animal rights as being antagonistic. So I'm wondering if you can speak about that. Why is there not more sympathy for looking at these connections with progressive folks on the left who are very concerned with issues of violence and exploitation? Why aren't we able to extend that to also think about animals?
Yeah, a good question. I've often wondered that myself. You'd think that people on the left who are concerned about justice and compassion would naturally want to extend that as far as they can. So I don't understand why people who are otherwise progressive are often antagonistic to animal rights. throughout history, I think people who have been at the forefront of struggles for human justice, the anti-slavery movement, child protection, women's rights, those people often may have been involved in animal rights issues as well. So I think that there's a long historical connection there, and I don't understand why more people don't recognize it and accept it and become engaged with it.
There's been a lot of criticism lobbed at the animal rights movement in North America as being classist and racist and bringing forward some of these oppressive ideologies in regards to animal issues. Have you found that in your own analysis that there's places that we're fumbling as an animal rights movement in Canada and we could do better in terms of making those meaningful connections and showing how social justice and animal rights are linked?
Well, I think that there isn't much of an animal rights movement in Canada. I think that there's a lot of room to develop one and to make these connections between various struggles for justice. But in terms of the people that I know who are involved in animal rights issues, I don't see the insensitivity to other forms of oppression.
So I wanted to talk with you about APE. The issues around racism come to the forefront when we talk about non-human apes, given the history of how racism has functioned and particularly how animals have been used as a metaphor for degrading various different people of color. And I think that apes are interestingly positioned because on the one hand, I think we're more sympathetic to their plight sometimes, but at the same time, they also create a certain anxiety that people want to distance themselves from, given the sort of racist history in particular, where, as I said, you know, people of color, slaves in the United States, were likened to non-human apes, and that was part of how racism and slavery were perpetuated. Can you speak about that history in a little bit more detail?
Sure. The similarity between other apes and ourselves certainly invites all sorts of speculations and imaginative processes. And in the colonial period, the emphasis was on apes as vicious monsters that were lurking in the jungle ready to eat people, although they're mainly vegetarians. But there was an easy slippage between speciesist depictions of apes and racist depictions of the human inhabitants of those areas. Because of the similarity and because Europeans encountered both apes and other humans in the same places and at the same time, it's in fact not all that surprising that Europeans would imagine them all to be inferior sorts of beings. It was easy for them to project all sorts of convenient ideas about savagery and sexuality onto those beings and regard them as being interchangeable, as dangerous, satanic groups. And then, after the 19th century, perversions of scientific understandings were used to cast these interchangeable figures as primitive forms of more advanced human beings, Europeans. So apes have always been powerful and consistent images in racist discourse because they're so convenient.
Do you also see this divergent group of animals as also being potentially the first bearers of rights because of that similarity? Do you think that there's a greater chance that they would be afforded, for example, legal rights before other animals?
Well, I think that we've seen steps in that direction in Spain and the Balearic Islands and so on, and the case in Austria with Heisel, the chimpanzee. So I think that that has gone ahead more than with other animals. I think that, obviously, apes do deserve equal consideration and equal rights under the law, but I don't think that that's based just on their similarity to us. My view of the Great Ape Project, for example, is that it's a first step towards broader rights for all animals, and that would be why I would support it. But I'd also support a project to achieve equal consideration for pigs or something. I think it might be easier for some people to accept consideration for apes, and I hope that that would also encourage them to think more seriously about other animals.
That's certainly my hope, too. It's concerning to think that people would say, well, non-human apes should be given consideration because they're like us. And does that just end up being a kind of entrenchment of human superiority again, that those that are most like us are deserving of rights, and that anybody else who doesn't seem like us in terms of our measures of intellectual capabilities or emotional capabilities is, again, left outside of that sphere of moral concern?
Yeah, I think so, too. But, you know, of course, I don't think we should stop with
apes. So I love this book, and one of the reasons why it's so compelling is that you take a lot of different tacks in the book, and you do analysis of visual representation. You talk about apes cross-culturally, and it's visually a very stunning book. And I'm wondering, what stands out for you most? What were some of the things that surprised you, or some of the things that you found most interesting in your research for APE?
Well, what affected me most, I guess, a section on entertainment and biomedical experimentation. If you read about some of the things that individual apes have been subjected to, for example, if you go to Fauna Foundation, the sanctuary for apes in Quebec, and other animals in Quebec, you can read the biographies of those individuals, and it's so sad to read about what they were subjected to. It's just heartbreaking. But I guess the most disturbing thing that I found in writing about apes was the fact that so many species of apes are facing imminent extinction. Orangutans in Borneo, on their habitat being destroyed by palm oil plantations. I was in Malaysia in the summer and flying over Borneo. That's all you see is these plantations. Their homes are being destroyed. There was a study that was done in 2007, I think it was, predicting that the habitat would be gone completely in about 15 years. But, you know, there isn't much left of it right now. It's devastated, and when the forest goes, so will all of those animals, not just the orangutans, but many other animals living there, monkeys and tigers and elephants and rhinos and sun bears and birds and so on. So the situation with palm oil in Malaysia and Indonesia, in Africa, logging and mining and oil extraction, destroying the habitat for ape populations there, destroying the ecosystems, the bushmeat trade, driving apes and other animals into extinction. It's really horrifying and staggering to think, you know, what we're doing to apes and other animals. You know, as we've just learned from the meetings in Japan, the Convention on Biological Diversity, you know, people saying, well, you know, this is the tipping point that we're coming up to now, and there's never been extinction on this scale, so it's really disturbing.
Such a clear example of the kind of false opposition that's sometimes discussed between environmentalism versus animal rights. Such a clear example of how when you destroy these natural habitats, clearly this is an animal rights issue as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've never seen any contradiction between environmentalism and animal rights, because animals live in an environment, so you want to preserve that.
Did you find any groups, organizations that inspired you that were working on behalf of apes? You've obviously, you're a supporter of the Fauna Foundation, and you read some of their biographies. I assume you actually went there then and got to meet some of these individuals?
Yeah, well, you know, I saw them through the fence, so I didn't really spend that much time with them, but it was nice to see them have, in the last years of their lives, some of them have some degree of freedom. And of course, it's not like they would have experienced if they'd been, you know, left alone in the forest, but at least they can move around and not be tortured every day.
So there's the Fauna Foundation. Who else do you look to as doing useful work for non-human apes?
Well, I think that, as I said, the Great Ape Project is something that people could support, but there are lots of other groups like the International Primate Protection League and Anti-Vivisection Societies. New England Anti-Vivisection Society has a particular campaign on stopping the biomedical use of apes. There are orangutan foundations, one in the UK, different conservation societies. There's one for gibbons, Conservation Alliance, I think it's call it.
I wanted to flag that because I know the advocacy piece is so important to you, that your scholarship is always indebted to and references grassroots activists. It's something that you're very passionate about. And so I wanted to give you the opportunity to speak about some of those folks that are on the ground doing work for animals.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we should all be inspired by activists who are really working hard to improve conditions for animals and doing a lot of noble, inspiring work.
We're down to about the last minute and a half, and I just wanted to turn it over to you if you have any last words that you wanted to say about APE or about Canada, animal rights.
I think that covered just about everything.
Well, thank you very much for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And of course, I'll put a plug in for something that you and I are both very passionate about and have been engaged with, which is the critical animal studies at Brock, where we've both put a lot of effort. You've been developing courses in critical animal studies since, I believe, 1993. And so for people who want to find out more about your work, they can go to the Brock sociology page as well. And you could actually come and study with Professor Sorensen, too, which would be great as well. So, John, thanks so much for your work, not only with these two books, but for all the work that you've done at Brock University. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. Once again, for people who missed, it was John Sorensen was the person we interviewed, and we were talking with him about his new books, APE and About Canada, Animal Rights. You can catch him doing his book talk in the near future, December 2nd, here at the University of Toronto in the George Ignatieff Theatre at 7 p.m. Tickets are $8 in advance. You can get them from ZooCheck at 416-285-1744 or ZooCheck's website, of course. And that's our show for today. Make sure to check us out online at animalvoices.ca, and you feel free to drop us a line at animalvoices@gmail.com. And add us as a friend on Facebook. We're going to be putting up show updates, posting things about our upcoming shows. This show was posted somewhere around Saturday, so people who are friends with us there knew what was coming up. So thanks for tuning in.